Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the launch of the World Bank Social Protection White Paper, Protecting All, Risk Sharing for Diverse and Diversifying World of Work. I wanted to also welcome Professor Andres Velasco, who will be chairing today's panel, and to our speakers today, all of whom have a connection to the LSE in some way. Professor Nicholas Barr, of course, who is our very own, Dr. Francesca Bastagli, Dr. Truman Packard, and Dr. Michael Rutkowski. This white paper is very appropriately launched at the LSE. I sometimes joke that, you know, if you set aside Bismarck, who kind of invented pensions, the modern welfare state was sort of invented at the LSE between the work of the Webbs and Beveridge and many, many, many faculty over the course of many years. Last year at the LSE, that all sort of came to a bit of a head as we had a series of events which we called Beveridge 2.0, which tried to rethink the welfare state for the 21st century. And this white paper is very much in the same spirit. I am convinced that part of the reason that everywhere in the world today we see a backlash against open societies, against globalization, against immigration, is because our systems of social protection have not kept up with our economies. And this white paper presents some very important, innovative ideas to try and have our systems of social protection catch up with an economy that is fundamentally different than the one that we had when the welfare state was first invented. So it presents some really innovative ideas and some important challenges, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing about them today. So let me now just turn over to Andres Velasco, who will chair and introduce the panel. Andres, over to you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much, Minouche. Thank you to our guests, friends from the World Bank and other institutions. I'm really delighted that the LSE can host the launch of this paper because it is a very good paper and a very timely paper. You won't be surprised to hear that the debates about inequality, social protection, jobs, redistribution are raging across the world, and it's a good thing that we're debating that. But of course, the challenge, the hard part, is to have a good debate as opposed to a trivial or highly politicized debate that leads nowhere. And I think this paper really sets us on the right track. There are at least four reasons why I think there's a big contribution there, and let me just very telegraphically mention them and then move on to the actual paper and the discussion. One is that it recognizes that the 21st century is different from the 20th. In some countries at some point, we had long lives of stable employment in one firm, and countries, particularly in Europe, frame their social protection schemes to fit that mold. That mold is gone because of TaskRabbit and Uber, or in many developing countries, of course, that never existed because most people were in the informal sector or did not have stable jobs. So anything we do along the lines of social protection has to focus on that new reality, or old reality in the case of some countries. Second of all, I think the paper distinguishes very helpfully between redistribution, that is to say, I give you money under all states of the world, and social insurance, that is, I give you money when bad things happen, but not in all states of the world, as an economist might say. And I think this distinction, which is very crucial, of course, is often lost in debates. Thirdly, it is a very thoughtful document in that it recognizes there are trade-offs. Different schemes have different effects on incentives. And therefore, the hard part, once you've agreed you want to do more social protection, is to craft these schemes so that you minimize the adverse impact on incentives, particularly the incentive to work and the incentive to work formally, which is, again, very key in developing and emerging markets. Last but not least, I like this report because it is readable. Which cannot be said with all due respect of every report that comes out of multilateral lending institutions based in Washington, D.C. And this is not simply an academic conceit. It's not simply that we enjoy reading things that are in plain language. But this is a report that ideally will not simply sit on somebody's shelf. It is a report that is called upon, I hope, to have a policy impact. And to have a policy impact, it has to be readable by policymakers and interested citizens. And the way the paper is written, the clarity of the proposals, the clarity of the language, I think very much takes us in that direction. So I celebrate that very much. Let me introduce the speakers now, and I'll do it in alphabetical order. Beginning with our very own Nicholas Barr, who's a professor of public economics at the LSE, of course, and whose contributions to the literature on pensions, on social welfare, on social protection is, of course, very vast and well known. Francesca Battagli is a principal research fellow and the head of the program on social protection at the Overseas Development Institute. Truman Packard, who will be presenting the sort of core of the report and to whom I will hand the microphone in a minute or two, is a lead economist at the World Bank on these matters, and he's been working on the issue of social protection and jobs and insurance for quite a while. And last but certainly not least, Michal Rutkowski is the global director, again at the World Bank, of the, I'm going to get this right because the World Bank changes labels all the time, so I used to know them, but you can never be sure, the Global Director for Social Protections and Jobs at the World Bank Group. So the way we're going to do this is Truman will present the core findings of the report. For that, he will have 15 minutes. We will move on to the members of the panel. They will have 3 or 4 minutes to give us their take on what is good and perhaps what, in addition, needs to be done when thinking about these issues, and then we will have a broad-ranging and, I'm sure, very interesting discussion. So, Truman, the floor is yours.
Show a video first.
I'm sorry, I forgot. There's a video. We are in 21st century. We get to watch videos before people speak.
The world of work is diversifying. Global disruptions such as technology, economic integration, social, demographic, and climate change have fundamentally altered the nature of work in countries at all development levels, including the developing world. Adjusting to these changes requires new risk-sharing policies. We need to find new ways to protect people from impoverishing and catastrophic shocks with better tools that are not tied to the workplace, to manage risk and uncertainty, to build and protect their human capital. In low-income countries, work has always been diverse and fluid. More than half of the workforce is part of the informal economy, moving from job to job and from wage to self-employment and back. These informal workers don't benefit from traditional employment-based social protection models. In high-income countries, disruptive forces are transforming how people work. People switch jobs every few years or engage in short stints in the new gig economy, combining part-time jobs and self-employment, earning a living in different ways. This unexpected convergence in the ways in which people across the world are working leads to a mismatch between these risk-sharing policies and the workers they are intended to protect. Up to now, we have relied on the workplace as a stable platform for providing protection. The employer is the implementing agent between the benefactors and the state social protection policies. Instead of relying so heavily on payroll financing and employment situation to provide protection, a broader system of public revenue and spending is needed for more reliable and equitable coverage against losses. Diversity and fluidity in the world of work challenge these two fundamental assumptions, requiring a rethink and a new model of worker protection. Rather than protect workers from change, governments should protect them for change. Adapting a new set of risk-sharing policies would provide a comprehensive package of safety nets, insurance, savings, and services with a guaranteed minimum coverage for all. By putting in place a new social contract, countries can reduce poverty, protect from impoverishing catastrophic losses, and help propel their economies. Learn more at worldbank.org/SP.
Now you've seen the movie, we're giving you the book. You tell us which one's better. Good, thank you. So, risk sharing is a more comprehensive tool, a term, than what we use at the World Bank Social Protection. We chose risk sharing under the with the guidance of Professor Nicholas Barr, who was our external independent thought leader and mentor and supervisor throughout this process. And those of you who have taken any of Professor Barr's courses will recognize his hand throughout the white paper. I think that one of the things that's important to point out is that as long as there have been societies, there have been social contracts. And as long as there have been social contracts, there's been risk sharing as a key clause in the social contract. And this is not to say that it's managing risk, what Professor Barr famously called the piggyback function of welfare states, is the only reason we have social protection. No, not at all. There are strong human rights justifications for the welfare state and social protection, strong arguments for inclusion. But risk sharing supports these in a way that makes it possible for people to take appropriate risks in order to grasp opportunities, making sure that poor people who are already living in chronic poverty don't suffer from misfortunate events that condemn them to even deeper levels of poverty or make it even harder for them to work their way out of poverty. So it's definitely only one component of why we have welfare states, but it's a supporting component and a vital component. Now, we are living in an enormous era of change. The change that has gotten the most press is automation and artificial intelligence. But this era of change is being felt in labor markets, both on the demand and the supply side, and indeed throughout the market as a whole, from lots of big global mega forces, whether those be technological change, shifting patterns of global value chains and trade, social change, demographic change, or climate change. They all have huge impacts in the labor market. As I said, that which has gotten the most press is the robots are coming, and they're going to take our jobs. But probably more fundamental than that in terms of technological change, the fact that we no longer necessarily have to organize production in a hierarchical firm structure in order to achieve scale and levels of productivity. We can go to market and rely on loose groups of self-employed people to come together around a project, disband, and come together again around a new project. We have different definitions of what is tradable versus what is untradable because of technology combining with global value chains. Probably more fundamental than any other impact in the labor market has been a disruption that's been unfolding over many years, which is the en masse entry into market work of women and the different preferences of time use and the different needs and constraints that presents both to the demand and the supply side. Similarly, a whole new group of people that traditionally hadn't been expected to work, the active elderly, because of longer, healthier lives, a generation from 60 to 80 who have similar, different expectations of how they want to remain active in the labor market that sometimes conflict with our traditional notion of a good job. And then, of course, because of climate change, entire industries, their viability being questioned, those industries that are quite reliant on a particular place or a particular season, but also massive inflights or outflights of populations that challenge both on the demand side and the supply side of the labor market. Now, one of the things that all of these forces have in common is that they are creating more diversity in the world of work than many of our codified social protection and welfare states assume. Now, diversity fluidity in the manner in which people engage in markets that challenge assumptions about the relative homogeneity of the role of work, the prevalence of wage and salary dependent employment, what has been called the standard employment contract, the stability of that relationship. Now, what you see here is a graph that shows the composition of how the poorest share of the labor force is working by different level of development. At the rightmost side is high-income countries, and there most people, even among the poorest, 66% are in wage or salaried employment, standard employment. But if you look over to the other side of the graph, in the lower income countries or the lower middle income countries, that share is quite a bit smaller. The majority of people are actually in self-employment, and what this doesn't capture is the enormous diversity even within these broad categories. There's also a lot of fluidity between these states. And so the message there is that we see in this time of disruption greater diversity in the world of work, a changing nature of work and production in the high-income countries where work has been relatively homogenous. That diversity and that fluidity has always been a feature of the world of work in the lower and middle-income countries. Now, diversity and fluidity challenge two key fundamental assumptions that underpin much of the structure of the welfare state, particularly social insurance, particularly worker protection, and that is that the employment relationship is sufficiently ubiquitous and sufficiently stable as to provide a stable platform for the delivery of social protection, the delivery of social insurance coverage. Now, what you see here in this graph is a 2x2 where on each of the axes we have the share of the working population that is contributing to social insurance in the manner assumed by the design of the system. In the 1990s, along the horizontal axis, and then the mid-20-teens, along the vertical axis. And what you can see along the diagonal is this clustering of countries, very little change. In some places, the share has gone up. In many places, the share has gone down, but it's remained fairly structurally stable. And that kind of contradicts many of the assumptions of policymakers and people like world bankers who advise them when we put up these systems. If you put the right policies in place, we will get the growth in the share of people who are working in factories and firms, and therefore being able to access social protection, and therefore participation will increase, and we will have a greater relevance. Now, this diversity and fluidity of which I spoke challenges this assumption that is the bedrock of the functionality of many of the social insurance structures. And so in this white paper, in this book, we argue that there has to be a shift in these bedrock assumptions. Those bedrock assumptions come from the second industrial revolution norms and ideas about the way that most people should work. In their general form, that work is homogenous. It's mainly men of age 18 to about 55 or 60 with very inelastic labor supply in full-time wage or salary employment. That employment relationship is relatively stable. It will last 10, 20, or 30 years. There will be intermediation between an employer, between the state that mandates or finances social insurance and social protection policies and the recipients and the beneficiaries of those policies. But the key intermediation function, the stalwart agent of policy implementation and effectiveness, is the employer and the firm. And that payroll is the most observable and therefore the easiest to tax economic flow in the economy that should then become the source of financing for most of the social protection. Our argument is that fundamentally the nature of work is changing in a way that is becoming far more diverse, far more fluid, in a way that challenges these assumptions. We require new assumptions, and the third and the fourth and maybe the fifth industrial revolution we will have to assume as policymakers that work is diverse, that work is fluid, that there is a much more direct relationship between the state, governments, and people. It's a G2P relationship, if you will, and that payroll is not the only or the most observable economic flow. Indeed, we already know that consumption is becoming a far more observable flow and therefore probably a good candidate for a flow that can be more observable, more taxable, and therefore the base of financing for a greater share of the social contract. So this world of work that's changing so much because of this, these disruptors in this time of change, it's evolving, it's becoming diverse, but that's not the problem. The problem is that when the second industrial revolution institutions were codified, we assumed that we were setting up these institutions for the ages, without movable parameters. And these dynamic forces are coming up and chalking against these very, very rigid institutions. Our mandate, the team that wrote the white paper, was to go back to basics, try to redefine what would be a comprehensive package of protections. And what we did is we went back to actuarial basics, good old public economics, and we defined a comprehensive package of protection with guaranteed minima at a core that were financed from public resources, public revenues, general revenues, the broadest possible financial base, the biggest possible risk pool in any given country, and where those are complemented from funds from external donors. Again, that becomes the most reliable, largest risk pool that any country can count on. Around that, a mandated minimum that would be individually fair. And in so doing, you would call on the individual to have an active contribution to their consumption smoothing. Around that, a nudged set of policies and programs through the use of behavioral science, through appropriate defaults to help people to make good choices. And then around that, purely market provision that's very, very vital to the viability of the entire package, given that if markets are providing safe and appropriately priced instruments, it puts less pressure on the other segments where the state has a more active role, sometimes a financial role. What goes into each segment? Well, this is where we rely heavily on actuarial principles, public economics principles, trying to see what is the most insurable of shocks. So the rarest shocks, the most catastrophic shocks, those shocks that if a person suffered them, their having suffered and not being covered would impose an unacceptable external loss on society. Making sure that those are protected in the core, and then the less extreme shocks for which markets are expected to be able to react in the other segments of the package. Now, for those of you who have taken pensions or social insurance and who know the terms, there are some more details there, and you can find that graph in the executive summary, but also in Chapter 3 in greater detail. What does this mean in more direct economic program terms? Now, if you've ever seen a graph like this on the vertical axis shows the level of protection, and then on the horizontal axis, how the entitlement is defined according to what you're earning now. This is supposed to be a depiction of the typical social protection system in a lower or middle income country today, where you have social assistance, social insurance, and market insurance. You have social assistance, which is really the only risk pooling, purely publicly financed risk pooling instrument that's available to people. But we've shaded it in a light blue here because lots of implementation challenges, not the least of which appropriate targeting, accurate targeting, means that many people are excluded. Many people who are actually entitled aren't receiving protection. But even if you just followed the rules, there's this vast empty gap this vast, great gap of the workforce that has no legal entitlement, never mind implementation challenges, between social assistance and traditional social insurance. Traditional social insurance is also priced very, very high because it's combining two distinctive and separable objectives. The objective of wealth redistribution and the objective of risk redistribution. And so what that does is it means that it's priced higher than it needs to be, and it creates huge disincentives for individuals and for firms to make access more broadly available. And then, of course, markets aren't working well. Markets don't work well in lots of places, but in low and middle income countries, the challenges are even greater. So the market instruments for insurance and savings that exist are few. They're not really reliable, and they usually are priced out of the reach of most people. So the policy recommendations are very straightforward as we make them in the white paper. First and foremost, expand social assistance so that you aren't making errors of exclusion, so that this vital risk pooling element that provides people access to the broadest possible risk pool in their country is more readily accessible. To separate in social insurance the objectives of wealth redistribution, which are noble objectives. It's not that we shouldn't be doing wealth redistribution, but the idea is to separate the wealth redistribution objectives from the risk redistribution objectives, and in that way, to lower the cost of risk redistribution so that it's more attractive for the individual and employers to provide that to a broader segment of the working population, and then work very hard to regulate financial markets and private financial instrument providers so that we can expand the supply of safe, reliable, and fairly priced savings and insurance instruments. So in our ideal universe, the picture looks like this. And to the picture, the expanded social assistance risk pooling picture, to the expanded role of actuarially fair social insurance and greater market provision of savings and insurance instruments, we have one novel instrument, and here it's represented in yellow. Not as novel as we would have liked to have been, because Santiago Levy 10 years ago came up with the first proposal of this instrument. And what it is actuarially priced social insurance, but with a subsidized premium, so that the subsidy is clear and limited, and the subsidy is 100% for poor people, and and some tapered subsidy for people who are not poor but still vulnerable to shocks, but that the payout is commensurate with the shock that sometimes can be experienced. Now this, for people who are familiar with the universal health care policy discussion, this is very much along the lines of what universal health care, our colleagues are advocating in order to achieve universal coverage. Now how does this tie with the labor market? If you have a comprehensive package of income protection in place, then you can do less with labor regulation. One of the things that's notable, particularly in low and middle income countries, is that labor regulation is getting more restrictive, largely because people do need protection. Labor markets are risky places, but governments don't yet have the fiscal capacity or the administrative capacity in order to do what I just described. And so what they do is they mandate that on employers. And this would work if everyone worked in a factory or a firm, but most people don't. Now, the World Bank in 2013 tried to push through the very, very long and sometimes contentious discussion around labor regulation. Should there be a minimum wage? Should there be restrictions on dismissals? With the concept of the labor market regulation plateau. Now, the labor market regulation plateau basically says that you have an undesired labor market outcome, which you see in the top of this graph, and then we have a plateau, the labor policy choice. You can do too little, you can do too much, and there's this broad green safe space in between where if you just apply the right levels of regulation, you can lower the undesired outcome and everything will be fine. Now, the problem with that is that in the low-income countries, and what you see on the other side of the slide, are two examples. Minimum wages as a share of the median wage and then notices of dismissal and how prevalently those are used. It's a little bit garbled here in this rendition, but basically the point that I want to make is that in the top part of the graph, the share of the minimum wage as a share of the median in the low-income countries is 84%, and in the low and medium-income countries is where you have to notify a third party and even get approval from the third party to dismiss one redundant employee. So they're way off this safe plateau. But there's a good reason why they're there. They're there because they can't do the things yet they can't provide the protection outside of the employment contract. So our message is to follow what used to be a prevalent idea back in the mid-1990s in Europe. It's called flex security. It's not like flex tension. It's well known and better regarded than that. And the idea there is to protect workers for change rather than to protect certain places of employment, certain firms, from the ups and downs of the economy, from the creative destruction process. What you see here is an illustration of this idea of flex security, where we have an index of labor market flexibility and an index of protections that are provided outside of the workplace. How much is spent on skills development? How much is spent on public health facilities? How much is spent on retraining and unemployment insurance? All of those in the protection index. Now, way ahead in the quadrant where we would like more countries to be, where there's high flexibility in terms of firms' choices about how they manage their human resources, but also high levels of protection that's provided outside of the labor contract, is Denmark. Denmark, of course, is the poster child for flex security, but also there is New Zealand outside of Europe. Sadly, most countries, a great cluster, particularly the African countries, which are here all in red font, are still in this quadrant where they have high de jure restrictions on firms' employment choices, as well as low levels of protection. And so the messages in the white paper are to move more people or more countries into that high flexibility, high protection quadrant. And for anyone who would characterize that message as a deregulation agenda, I have news for you. In order to provide assistance that is really impactful and appropriate for people as they make transitions, that actually involves far bigger government, far more capable government than just a very tight labor code. And just to give you an example here, what we are calling for is much greater effort than governments have ever put into re-employment support, re-employment assistance. And not only greater spending, although that is definitely much needed, but you know, we have another message for the finance ministers. It's not just more money, but better spending, a smarter way of structuring these deployments of policies that is much more attuned to the shock that caused the displacement. Is the shock systemic, a whole country being affected, or is the shock idiosyncratic, specific to an individual or to a community? Is the shock transient, something that's just going to blow over in the next 2 years, or is it going to be really permanent? Is this like a fundamental shift in the technology that's being brought to bear and therefore a displacement that's going to happen because of that change in technology? We have lots of knowledge about the transient shocks and what's best to deploy. And we need to use that knowledge better. We don't know as much about what it takes to respond to the more permanent systemic shocks and how to help people recover from those in order to find new jobs. This whole way of thinking will require far more active and far more representative tables of dialogue and discussion between the stakeholders, employers, workers, and of course government representing the interests of all the rest. And what we argue is for the table of dialogue to have more than just three sides. This is year 100 of the existence of the concept of tripartite. We celebrate with our colleagues in ILO this important dynamic of dialogue. It has been critical and vital to keeping peace and social harmony for so many years. We also think that while this still probably works very, very well at the level of the firm and at the level of the sector, where each party is clearly identified and the interests of each party are clearly identified, when we go to the national level, something broader, more representative is required. Now, we tongue-in-cheek sort of propose pentapartite. We don't know whether it's five sides. We know that it has to be an odd number because somebody has to have the tie-breaking vote. But, you know, whether it's five or seven or nine, who knows? You don't want to get too many sides and therefore have an unproductive cacophony. But the point is that what we have right now at the level of the country setting national worker protection and welfare policy, we think, is not sufficiently representative of the diversity of work. The final chapter of this book addresses the very challenging questions of how to transition between what is now in place in most countries and the nirvana that we have described. And that is a combination of both fiscal challenges, resources, but also administrative challenges, you know, the capacity for governments to observe what's going on in the economy. And what we do is we create an index that charts this fiscal space and administrative capacity. One of the things that we observe is that whereas what we're proposing probably costs double of what governments are currently spending on social assistance, at least, we note that many governments are already spending five times that or 10 times that on fuel price subsidies or other energy price subsidies. And this is spending that has the explicit objective of redistribution, sometimes even the explicit objective of risk sharing. And so our argument is that the fiscal space is actually there. It's just being occupied by bad policies right now. And so our argument is that that can be shifted, the capacity can be built given what the advances in digital economy and digital capacity. Indeed, some of the African countries are already using mobile telephony in order to provide more effective savings and insurance to a broader swathe of the working population. I'm going to conclude with these five very tweetable messages. First of all, the foundations of effective risk-sharing policy is poverty prevention, risk pooling that is broadly available. I talked about subsidized protection from catastrophic losses. The key here is that it's financed from the broadest possible base, certainly broader than statutory contributions from payroll. When you have these robust income support programs in place, wherever and whenever people work, then the choices on individuals and firms are significantly less distorted. What that would allow is for governments to put their regulatory efforts in helping people to make transitions that are safe and that represent a step to prosperity, rather than having to restrict people's choices and try to keep people in jobs that are no longer viable. Now, given how daunting the resource challenges are, the capacity challenges, this is going to have to be a step-by-step, gradual process. Like our colleagues in the health policy space, we prefer to speak of a progressive universalism, and what that means is that we won't go super, super slow. It just means that we won't take any step without being certain that it's going to improve the lot of the least well-off first and foremost. Finally, digital technology, one of the great disruptors of which I spoke at the outset of this presentation, actually is our greatest hope for mobilizing a greater share of fiscal resources and improving the capacity of governments to deliver on these promises. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Truman. It's not a simple package, but it is an appealing package. I have lots of questions to ask and lots of issues that I'd like to raise, but I'm going to exercise some self-restraint and pass it on to the speakers/discussants/commentators beginning in alphabetical order with Nick Barr.
Well, good morning, everybody. I want to start off by saying that the 21st century is different from the 20th century. In other words, the past is no longer on offer. Risks have changed, labour market risks are different, family risks, skills risks. So the argument is actually very simple. If the risks have changed, then the design of insurance needs to change. So what we've heard from Truman and what I want to unpack a little bit more is what social insurance in the future might look like. And that view to the future has at least three elements. The first is the way you finance benefits. And there it's important to split benefits up into their purposes.
Thank you.
Poverty relief benefits should be financed from government resources, mainly taxation, things like child benefit, things like non-contributory pensions. Insurance benefits, of which health is one of the major ones, should not be financed from a payroll tax, because lots of workers in the future won't have an employer, but again should be financed from broadly based general taxation. Contributory benefits, consumption smoothing benefits are you guys saving now to transfer resources to yourself when you've retired. Clearly, that has to be contributory. And the question is, how do you organize contributions which previously have been organized through employment when a lot of people don't have employers? And that brings us to the second element in the package, which Truman has just mentioned, electronic payments. There's a slide that I have stolen from a colleague at the World Bank who came up with this riveting figure that in Kenya, 10% of formal labor income, formal labor income is 10% of GDP. Electronic transactions are 50% of GDP, which makes clear the scope for electronic transactions. A couple of months ago, I asked our teenage tech-savvy grandchild whether he knew what a modem was. And he looked at me and he said, no. Mm-hmm. Now, to any one of us sort of a bit older than you guys, modems were a fundamental part of connecting to the internet. Yet, for today's teenager, it's all a thing of the past. Wi-Fi is all that they've ever known. You go to a market, I was in Delhi recently, go to the market there, everybody's on their smartphone. So this is now getting close to a universal technology. So that's a second element, electronic payments. Slightly more speculative is, if you have contributions, you pay them electronically, what do you base them on? And as Truman has mentioned, in the past we've based it on income, particularly formal sector employment income. Consumption potentially is a much better bet. Consumption varies less than income. So if you tie contributions to people's consumption spending, you can do it on an individual basis, you can do it electronically, you can think about, is it the individual, is it done on a family basis, do you accumulate family contributions? People with multiple sources of income, it doesn't matter because it all goes out through consumption. And there's been some pilots on it. I shall just end with, there was an article in the Financial Times about a year ago. There is an app that they're testing out where you go into Costa Coffee, you order your latte, which costs £3.20, and you get zapped for £4, and the 80 pence goes into your savings account. Now, that's a sort of nudge. It's mm-hmm. a pilot scheme, but it's the sort of thing you could build on. So I think the great welcome for this paper is it doesn't look to the past and try and make things better. It says the world is changing. We should change the design to go with it. And I think that's exactly the right way to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick, for that very pithy yet deep summary of what the paper is about. Francesca, floor is yours. Either one.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much, Truman, and thank you. It's great to be here. I'm getting lots of flashbacks sitting here in this beautiful room. Mm-hmm. But beyond those, the memories, Thank you very much, Truman, for the presentation and for the report. There's so much to talk about, and I've been given very little time, so I'm going to pick on one, maybe two points. But I do want to come back to the question of the role of contributory social protection. So, the report very clearly makes the point that we need to rethink the assumptions underpinning the way contributory social protection has been designed, and I think there's, you know, we can all very much agree on that and recognize that. At the same time, it seems to me in my mind that on some of the parts of what is being proposed here, again, some big assumptions are being made that are not too dissimilar to the ones that underpin contributory social protection. I'll be very specific. You do emphasize, or you know, this morning we have emphasized the potential role of relying more heavily on social protection funded through general taxation. You mentioned that this is the largest and most reliable pool of funding. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, many countries actually struggle very much in terms of revenue and grow, you know, raising additional revenue to finance social policy. By the way, just as a parenthesis, we're talking protection and risk sharing here, but there's also education, health, and a lot more that governments need to finance. And of course, Professor Barr, you brought in health a second ago, but I mean, just as an aside, so we also need to be funding those schemes via the public finances. But importantly, in addition to the levels question, which is how are we going to raise that revenue? And you provide, in the presentation, some options, but I don't think they're going to take us all the way, and in some countries they're not really an option. But the other question is, what are the instruments we're going to rely on? So how are we going to meet those levels of financing, and what are the tools available? Why do I say this? Because depending on what instruments we rely on, and I know you know this very well, these will have a whole host of implications, for instance, from a distributional perspective, so an equity perspective, as well as from a sustainability perspective, the political economy of financing and taxation. All of this to say that I think we need to do both. I mean, we need to. So, just to come back to sort of the assumption underpinning the messages here is that, and I think one of the key messages is that, yes, public finances and relying on general taxation can be more effective, mm-hmm. can be more efficient, can be more equitable than relying on the current contributory setup of schemes. But the assumption underpinning is that you have a progressive tax system underpinning this. So, yes, let's shift towards higher reliance on public finances if we have a progressive tax system in place. And the point I'm trying to make is that in many countries that we're talking about, we do not have a progressive tax system in place. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to build them. Yes, we have to absolutely, our efforts need to be there precisely on that. But I question the idea, and again, I don't think this is an idea that has come across, but it is somewhat suggested in the way forward, that we don't continue to reform and strengthen the contributory side, adjusting policy to new realities. By the way, we continue to talk about many new realities. Many of these are, of course, not new. When you mentioned women entering the labor market or paid employment, of course, if you look at the history of coverage, not only coverage, and the questions of provision of social protection for women, but also the adequacy of social protection for women, this has historically been an issue. This is not new. Related, of course, to women's work patterns, interruptions in paid work, the nature of part-time work, they're more likely to take on low-paid work. This, in turn, is related to wider forms of discrimination and norms that we don't need to necessarily go into now, but I was struck by, the mention that the entry of women into the labor market has given rise also to sort of disruption because of new preferences or different preferences around time use, mm-hmm. which, yes, new and not so new. This mm-hmm. boils back to wider questions about what is work, which I'm going to come back to in a minute, time permitting, mm-hmm. how we value work that isn't paid. The framing of much of the discussion here today is around paid work. Mm-hmm. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So just to say, when we look at the experience of countries in practice, and this has come across again strongly, we are seeing some of what's being described here happening. And in particular, we see, yes, an expansion in non-contributory, so either tax-financed or importantly, donor-financed social protection. I won't go down the donor route. I'll park that for a moment. But even where if we focus on policy funded through general taxation, we are seeing that expansion. And part of this expansion is driven precisely by a concern about coverage and achieving universal social protection in terms of coverage. And I think, you know, we've seen great progress where countries, thanks to the adoption, for instance, of social pensions, are seeing an important expansion. Categories of workers and wider, you know, in groups in society that were previously excluded as a result of this, you know, static contributory system, now accessing social protection. But one key thing that we're observing alongside this expansion in coverage is a continuing or persistent gap in adequacy. So the average values of transfers that are financed to general taxation are lower than the values that come, you know, that are paid through contributory schemes. This doesn't need to, you know, I'm not suggesting this has to have any repercussion on what route we take, but it does have implications and is linked to wider considerations around the financing source of these different types of transfers. So I think that has to be borne in mind. The second key point is that what's happening in countries, and that hasn't really come across here, is that there are some very interesting processes underway to adjust contributory social protection to expand coverage to categories of workers that were previously excluded. And this has gone largely or almost entirely unmentioned here. I think that that's a bit of a pity. I think we do need to pay attention to that, where that is happening. So we've seen, you know, the aggregate numbers. I think that the case here is made very strongly in aggregate terms. We're not seeing the formalization we thought we were going to see. We're not, you know, we're seeing this emergence in some sectors of non-standard forms of employment, persistence of informality in some sectors. Yes, that's true. It's also true that it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. We have also seen processes of formalization. We have also seen processes of adjusting the contributory branch of social protection to reach workers that were previously excluded. And I think we need to talk about that. I think my time is almost up, but just one final quick remark going back to the question of work. I do have to say I am struck that we are talking about, yes, risk sharing, the future of work, disruption in the world of work. We've hardly mentioned unpaid work. One of the, I think, beautiful things about these conversations, including, you know, thinking through the future, is that it has thrown up questions about the way in which we conceptualize work. We have, in a lot of the work we have done, and I think this is very much reflected in this report, we have equated work with paid work. This is frankly part of the problem. We need to think about work that includes unpaid work, how we value work, its valuation, and of course, importantly, its distribution across members of society. Importantly, of course, the question that remains and is not at all trivial of the unequal distribution of unpaid work across the sexes and its undervaluation.
Thank you, Francesca, for those very valuable remarks. Michal.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Andres. So I asked myself a question, which is as follows. If we believe in the messages of the white paper, and I certainly do, what are the three top challenges for further policy and implementation work? And I think they are as follows. The first is the re-employment assistance. The white paper puts a lot of emphasis on the need to help workers for change, not against change. And this is a very tall order for active labor market policies, especially in the reality in which we know that around 70% of ALMPs evaluated through a rigorous impact evaluations don't actually work. Here we have two types of problems, and Truman alluded to them. We have different type of shocks. We have transients and permanents. We have systemic and idiosyncratic. And when it comes to transient shocks, we have the whole range of instruments from wage subsidies, retraining, entrepreneurship support, intermediation, search support. But policymakers very often do not apply them to the right shocks. There is very little in policymaking consideration what kind of shock I am addressing, what kind of instrument is appropriate for that shock. That's about transient shocks. When it comes to permanent shocks, it's even worse. I think our knowledge base about the link between instruments and the type of shocks, whether they are idiosyncratic or systemic, is limited, and more knowledge building here is absolutely necessary. How to achieve this proper assignment of instruments to the type of shock, that is a non-trivial matter, and it may call on a different, I would say, governance process of re-employment assistance. One of the ideas which is alluded to in the white paper, which I like a lot, is to think about re-employment assistance the same way we think about the health systems management, in which we have a very clear split between purchaser and provider. And we could think about the same way about ALMPs, because the objectives of health system management and ALMPs is quite similar. It's about balancing equity in access to services with financial sustainability. So the system in which there is a split between purchaser and provider, and the purchaser would be a state, but providers are diverse, and the main service provider diagnoses needs and then provides a referral to specialists of various services, might be a system that could vastly improve how we apply ALMPs and how effective they are. Australia Job Network is modeled upon that and is a very good example of going this way. That would require actually going into the issues which health goes, which is risk assessment, which is tools of statistical profiling and similar. And finally, in these areas, obviously we will be in a very similar dilemma. Is fee for per beneficiary better or fee for service? Fee per beneficiary keeps costs low. There is no over prescription of treatment in ALMPs. Fee for service discourages scheming at low cost, but the dilemma is there. So that's the first point. The second point is this graph, which I like a lot, which is tripartite versus pentapartite. And without trivializing, it's a very serious problem. The very serious problem is how to cover those in non-standard employment contracts and those who are self-employed. The trade unions don't like pentapartite because it splits them further. But I don't think we are hooked on pentapartite. There may be various ways of doing it, but it is a very serious issue and very important for effectiveness of wage bargaining, how those workers could be represented, and there could be various different models. The important point is that the tripartite as implemented now effectively excludes them, because neither government represents them properly, nor current trade unions have actually an interest to embrace them, and much more is needed in this area. Finally, the last point, which I think is quite critical, is the coverage of informal sector workers by social insurance. And here actually is a very important dilemma Francesca referred to. Francesca talked about expanding existing social insurance to cover other workers. So we are, as the World Bank, doing serious work, notably in Africa, trying to see what's the most effective way of increasing coverage. And so far, we are quite pessimistic about expansion of existing systems, because they are clearly built for regular contributions, they are clearly built for payroll-based contributions, they are clearly built for a system in which once you reach retirement age, then you can either do one lump sum or an annuity, but they are not suited to the need of informal sector workers. That requires allowing for irregular contributions, that requires allowing for withdrawals for different contingencies than just reaching old age, because of various family shocks and events, and that require reaching far, not to payroll tax, but to much broader taxation base, which current pension funds are not capable of. And in that context, I think it is useful to remind that if you look at Kenya, payroll tax is 8% of GDP. However, 90% of mobile transactions are observable and can be used as a basis for those voluntary nudged social security contributions. And this is really where we see more of a future there, rather than in expansion of a current rigid systems for civil servants and parastatal employees. And final, very final point relates to what Francesca was talking about, and she was quite rightly so, I think, focused on progressivity, but I would emphasize the need to think of progressivity of the whole package, taxes plus benefits, and very often regressive taxes could actually form a basis of creating a benefit package that is very progressive, and therefore the whole package is progressive, and ultimately this is what matters. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to take advantage of the chair's privilege and ask each one of the discussants one very brief question. I hope I will get a very brief answer, and then we will open it up. We have about half an hour left for discussion. So let me begin with Truman. I was delighted to hear that flexicurity is back, that it is not entirely dead. But the reason why it has been semi-dead, not only in Europe where it originated, but elsewhere, is that it is politically very hard to implement, because traditional trade unions don't like it, because it means that workers trade off certain benefits for uncertain benefits down the road. I can report to you that when I was in government in Chile, I tried to advance it an agenda, went to Denmark, went to Sweden, agitated a great deal, got nowhere. So how do we make this politically feasible? You must have some thoughts on that. Big question, hope you give me a brief answer.
Okay. The brief answer is everything that we're proposing is politically very, very difficult. I think the great tragedy around flexicurity is that it was a great, great idea that was only partially implemented. Governments were very enthusiastic about the flexibility part, and there was far less enthusiasm about the protection part. As I said before, we have been accused of promoting a deregulation agenda because there is this assumption that, like in the past, it's very well based, that governments wouldn't follow through with the protection part. Preparing people, protecting people for changes is very hard. Arguably, this is why government for years and years and years has been outsourcing this through mandates on employers. That's arguably the reason. It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. And so our argument is that we have to have better follow-through. Some of the better examples of this is what was done in Austria around the very permanent structural change out of steel production. But for a clean, green growth agenda going forward, pushing on, powering past coal is going to require us to be much better at helping people to reskill, upskill, and redeploy. That's just another imperative that has nothing to do with the imperatives of which I've spoken about today. So I suppose my response is that maybe the ground has shifted sufficiently so that there is more of a constituency around the idea and greater median voter support, for this shift in regulatory emphasis away from protecting people from change to protecting people for change.
Thank you. Nick, the name of Santiago Levy popped up a couple times in discussion. For those of you who might not know who that person is, he's a very influential Mexican policymaker who's written about the unforeseen effects that social protection had in Mexico, because when you give uncontingent benefits to those in the informal sector, perhaps you encourage the informal sector to grow. The paper deals with that problem in two ways, the most important of which is that it keeps these uncontingent benefits financed by the Treasury small, and it talks about ways of avoiding bad incentives by, you know, avoiding those cliffs in which, you know, if you make one more peso, you lose everything that the government gives you. The problem there, of course, is that if the central insurance package is too small, it may be politically hard to sell, or the pressures might be there for it to grow, and therefore we get into the Santiago Levy problem. How do we think about that, and how do we think about, you know, avoiding cliffs in reality? Because the concept of good in practice is hard to do. You've been thinking about this for a long time. What more can you tell us about it?
I mean, I think the core of Santiago Levy's argument is that if I work for LSE and because of that I have to pay national insurance contributions, that has worked traditionally in Western countries with high institutional capacity. Mm-hmm. But in poorer countries with less capacity to administer and with less fiscal capacity, the contribution that's required goes up and up and up. Right. And that gives me an incentive to bail out into the informal sector. So Santiago's key point was avoid tax wedges connected with employment. Right. Avoid any taxes that you pay only because you are in formal sector employment. And that's why moving away from employment-related contributions to broadly based taxation, whether it's income tax or, as I've indicated, possibly increasingly useful consumption tax, means you get the revenue without creating a wedge. So that was the first part of his argument.
Absolutely.
A separate part was then avoiding cliff edges, and that's a question of benefit design.
Right.
And clearly it's not easy, but I'm a great fan of non-contributory benefits like social pensions and child benefit. And just if I may, a tiny response to Francesca. I'm totally in favor of progressive taxation, but actually most of the progressivity happens on the benefit side. So if you've got a proportional tax financing a flat rate benefit, the overall system is highly progressive.
Actually, I am distraught because that's what I was going to ask Francesca, but Nick... It's popped up a couple of times. Let me just maybe just emphasize the point very briefly. One is that even if the benefit side is not wildly progressive, the overall balance of taxation plus benefits is likely to be progressive. And secondly, I think slowly but gradually, and especially in the current political climate, we are moving toward greater progressivity of tax schemes, even in developing countries. So maybe your concern is being alleviated somewhat, or maybe not.
Yes, I think we see positive developments. But it's just to say, on the question of... the bottom line is what matters is the effect of the whole, right? The transfers and the tax system. And that's true. And ultimately, which is why it's so important to discuss the financing angle when we discuss where spending is going. A lot of the conversation when we come to social protection and even risk sharing is around coverage issues, which is all very well. But of course, if we're not looking at where the funding is coming from, we're missing part of the story, and I think that's very clear. And indeed, what matters at the end of the day from a sort of perhaps first round sort of incidence approach is who's paying what and benefiting from what as a whole. So you might have a regressive tax system that is then, as you say, corrected through progressive poor spending. I think that's, yes, that's, you could look at it that way. But of course, it's not just that matters when we talk about tax and transfer and fiscal policy more widely. In particular, once you start to bring in dynamics and the political economy angle of things, the story changes a little. So for instance, the regressivity of certain types of taxes does start to matter because people's perceptions of fairness matter. And in turn, those, and this is, well established, this in turn influences people's willingness to pay taxes. It influences the extent to which fiscal policy and government policy more widely can help trigger processes of accountability. Those things that potentially, yes, a progressive fiscal system, an equitable, fair system can achieve. But if you do have strong elements of regressivity, that will be in the tax system alone. That I think... And we're seeing it, frankly, even these days. It does get picked up by the population. And so I think we can't forget that political economy element, which in turn then also, by the way, links back to conversations about the role of the social contract and the potential for the tax and transfer system together to establish and strengthen relations between citizens and the state. I just wanted to come back to the fact that also, yes, we are seeing important or examples of progress in both in collecting increasing levels of revenue and in terms of the options for raising additional revenue. Of course, consumption came up a lot in the today. We're well aware that yes, consumption presents and consumption taxes, for instance, present a huge fantastic opportunity. There are also, as is well known, concerns about precisely the incidence of these taxes. They can be regressive, they're not always, but they can be. And again, yes, let's rely on them. Let's also bear that in mind. So we do need to be talking also about other types of taxes. And once we do that, once we start looking at taxing property, wealth, high net wealth individuals, corporations, and others that are untapped resources in many countries, and we need to be doing better and more about taxing them, Yeah, I think we need to be talking about that. We need to be doing more about that. But then, sorry if I'm smiling, but then we come back to the, you know, some of the challenges that we do find when it comes to contributions. So some of the challenges that can be met, that we are working on and will be progressing on in terms of raising additional revenue through the sort of more public general taxation angle of things, are not actually that dissimilar from some of the challenges we face when it comes to collecting contributions and the kind of incentives or disincentives those create. Because on the tax side, and ultimately they are all taxes, by the way, they're different but frankly equivalent challenges. And just a quick point on technology, we talked quite a lot about how technology can help in terms of delivering transfers, identifying and collecting taxation. Yes, it can also be tremendously useful in collecting contributions, in identifying income and, for instance, work that is taking place that previously was not identifiable, which, by the way, was one of the challenges and difficulties around when it comes to certain types of work, domestic work, work that is often carried out in the informal economy. We are seeing examples of, and you know, we're doing a lot of work around how these technologies, forms of work linked to platforms, including on-demand platform work, for instance, in the domestic sector, is making work that was previously hard to see visible. We are seeing now work that wasn't being captured. We are seeing who the workers are, even if they're not classified as such. We are seeing employers, even if they're not classified as such. So there are big opportunities there, too. And I just, you know, I think, you know, when I was saying we need to do it all, I think we do need to do it all. We do need to continue to work on the contributor side. We do need to, you know, make sure we strengthen, establish, build progressive tax systems.
Great. Michal, very briefly, we live in populist times. Most policies that make headway politically have slogans that fit into a small sign, drain the swamp, build a wall, take back control. As I read this report, I kept thinking, how could I put it on a small sign? And I had difficulty thinking of a way to do that. But you've been in the business of explaining and selling this report to all kinds of stakeholders around the world. How do we do that?
Well, you have a tagline, protecting all. In fact, all those slogans you referred to, they typically protect a part of the society, not the whole society. When you talk about drying the swamp, it is about particular people who are winners now and would lose otherwise, but it is not about the whole society. If you talk build a wall, it actually means, it's a shorthand of saying there are certain people in the society that may lose from immigration. We need to protect them. I think a very big selling point for the ideas of the white paper is precisely the notion of progressive universality. We are saying at the end of the day, everybody with no exception who needs social protection should be getting it. It needs to start with the poorest and more vulnerable. That's why we call it progressive universalism. But at the end of the day, this is universalism. It's modeled upon thinking about universal health insurance. So everybody who at any given point in time needs social protection gets it. And I think this universalist message is the most important one. The universalist in the sense that it does not protect one group just because they have a good, stable employment contract better than another group because they are in subsistence agriculture. It does not protect those who are in urban areas better than in rural areas. And I could do, you know, more comparisons like that, but I guess that it's not only a biggest selling point that may work, but also a very true one when it comes to both the content and the spirit of the white paper.
That is a good line, although I should note that progressive has two meanings. One is gradual, the other one is left wing. You're using it in the earlier meaning, but some people may read it in the latter way, which is very clever indeed. Okay, I'm going to get scolded by LSE events because we're not leaving enough time for Q&A, and I'm mindful of that, so please, the floor is open. And there's a microphone. There are two microphones out there for people who'd like to raise questions.
Hi, it's a question for Truman. I'm Martin Evans. I'm one of Francesca's colleagues. The diagram where you showed the small block of social assistance and then the triangles with a big gap in the middle, I thought was great, except it misses a huge form of risk sharing, which are the non-state forms of risk sharing that operate hugely and to a much bigger scale and for a much bigger effect in sub-Saharan African countries and other low-income economies.
Asian countries.
Those involve the transfer between households of cash and near cash, but also risk-sharing savings groups, insurance groups, which are all run informally, maybe regulated, maybe not. Now, the incentives for work, I understand from what you propose, I think is intellectually very exciting, but missing out the effects of incentives on informal risk sharing, I think could be a big mistake. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could inform us about what your thoughts are on that.
Given that we have little time, let's take two or three questions and then we'll revert back to the panel. In the back there, yes? Yes.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, this is also a question for Truman. In your discussion of the purpose of social protection, you know, you did mention that risk sharing is only one vital element of that. And I guess in the conceptualization of an employment-based social protection system, it was also recognizing that actually those who benefit the most from labor also have a responsibility to contribute to their welfare. So in other words, firms and employers have a direct relationship or a direct obligation to support the welfare of their workers. And in your kind of explanation of moving away from the employer at the center of the state-citizen relationship to having, you know, basically just having the direct state-citizen relationship, that seems to kind of forget that actually their employers continue to exist, they continue to use and rely on labor. And I'm interested in understanding, you know, this model that very heavily relies on consumption taxes from the way it's presented in the report does seem to really let employers and corporations quite heavily off the hook. And I understand that that's partly to do with, you know, potentially a political, you know, where you start in the selling of this idea. But I would like to know, you know, many of the countries that have had trouble covering people with social protection have also seen very large-scale tax evasion, capital flight. You know, how do you see this model ensuring that actually it's not just putting even more onus on very low-income individuals to finance their own welfare?
Third row here. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. So many questions I can ask. Particularly the question I want to ask is now on this insistence on actuarial fairness, which mm-hmm. is my favorite euphemism for, you know, no redistribution. And I'm just wondering to what extent that insistence is informed by past experience around social security privatization. I was going to ask particularly maybe about the Chilean experience, and now mm-hmm. I'm terrified to find out that the chair worked for the Chilean government, so I have many particular insights there. But is that is that not essentially what the World Bank's been kind of preaching for a lot of time? Targeted social security, targeted safety nets, and private social insurance. And I was wondering whether you have any reflection on how that works out for women, for low-income workers, for those in the more irregular forms of employment, and whether we haven't learned over the last 20 years or so that the contributions they can make are just too slow to really too low to really end up add up to anything in the end.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So the World Bank is advocating no redistribution. Okay, you guys, we'll have some explaining to do.
It's not true.
I know it's not true. Or at least I'm sure. I know you know. I mean, I know you will say it is not true. There was one other hand up back there somewhere. Maybe not anymore. Yes, please.
I want to ask a question especially related to the flexicurity proposal. So having worked with the private sector, what I find really challenging is sort of like to bring the conversation and get the buy-in from the private sector to support the flexicurity system. So the rationale for them is that they are going to get high-skilled labor anyways, even if they don't provide those skills training for their employees to cater for the future changes. So it is very difficult to persuade them to support and develop the reskill training systems for their employees, especially for those women and young people who are marginalized in the labor market. So how do you, what are the suggestions from your side to sort of like connect the dialogue between the policymakers and the private sector and make it politically feasible for the plan to take place?
Great. So we have a set of four very good questions. We have a set of four very good speakers. Match made in heaven. Why don't we go back in order? Begin with Michal and end with Truman.
Okay. So
and we have 5 minutes left, so that's a little over a minute per speaker, please.
So I will just limit myself to commenting on the question about separating poverty prevention from reallocation of consumption over lifetime, or at least this is the way I'm rephrasing the question. Indeed, we have been advocating for that, to have pension systems that do not have distortions and that have actuarial incentives to continue paying contributions and then working long, because then increases at the retirement age are very big. And then that type of redistribution is a redistribution of consumption over lifetime is a very different matter than poverty prevention that should happen through social safety net and, depending on the income of the country, through minimum pension. And we are also supportive, if needed, of social pensions, especially if contributory records are patched and therefore cannot be used for a decent pension. I think the comment I wanted to make is we are not advocating for privatization. We accept fully that a good modern actuarial pension systems could be in the form of non-financial defined contribution, such as the one in Sweden, for instance, which does not employ private pension funds, but still has incentives to contribute and has all the microeconomic properties of the funded. And let me also say, and maybe this is my service to Andres here, but that I don't think it would be even fair to blame the Chilean pension systems for other performance because of its structure. I think the key issue here is the fact that there is a very low contribution density. Mm-hmm. So if you have a good modern pension system, which I think actually Chile does, then if you have low contribution density, then obviously people get low pensions. But this is not because of poor investment of the funds or because poor structure of the system. It's a deeper labor market issue of non-contributing. So this is what I wanted to address. Thank you.
Well, you defended Chile. Let me defend the World Bank in one sentence. In Chile, the World Bank has been advocating, in fact, a mixed system with a big non-contributory solidarity pillar, which is exactly what we put together 10 years ago. We're spending about a point of GDP precisely on minimum guarantees for low-income people, which is very, very heavily redistributive. And Nick, in his private capacity as an advisor, and the World Bank both played a role in helping design that. So the World Bank is not always as bad as it seems. Francesca has very kindly agreed, or actually not agreed, offered to give up her time so that other people may explain the contents of the report further. And if Francesca has not yet changed her mind, we will do that. So we'll pass it on to Nick and then go back to Truman.
I'd just like to echo Michal's point about actuarial fairness. If it's a voluntary individual policy, you get out of it on average only what you put in. That's not what this is talking about. You've got three questions. First of all, poverty relief and insurance should not be done this way. It should be done out of broadly based taxation. So you're mainly talking about the consumption smoothing element. Secondly, what risk pool are you talking about? And you're not talking about a selected group of highly paid workers, it's everybody in the group. And the third point is, is there individual risk rating? Do high risks pay more than low risks? And with social insurance, the answer is no. So everybody's in the pool, contributions are not related to individual risk, and poverty relief is dealt with through other mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So it's actuarial fairness is right in the sense that Truman used it, but in the context of social insurance, it's very different from individual risk-rated insurance policies.
Very important point indeed. Thank you, Nick. Truman, you will have the last but brief word.
Okay. I think that I'll focus on this question about employers and their obligation. In Chapter 4, the very first section that deals to do mainly with labor policies calls for a more balanced deployment of taxation. I think that the financial
active contribution toward the welfare state, being a good corporate citizen, can take the form of lots of different ways. It doesn't have to come in the form of a statutory contribution as it has been exercised in the form of a social insurance contribution. I think that that's actually letting them off the hook much more than appropriate deployment of corporate taxation, appropriate deployment and reform of the global taxation norms and structures to match the 21st century and the economy we have, rather than the economy that we had. So that's dealt with quite frontally and quite explicitly in that first section of chapter 4. I think the whole question about taxation broadly. Yes, much of what we are advocating works best if you have a progressive taxation system in place already. Unfortunately, that's not where countries have put emphasis. We see countries enacting labor codes that look a lot like Southern European labor codes from the 1970s in this very day. And they're putting an enormous amount of effort and talent and resources in order to put that in de facto, never mind putting it into practice. Our argument is to change the aspirational goal of institutional development. So if you change the aspirational goal for what the long-run goal is of where you want to see your institutions go, the choices that you make from day to day are going to be very, very different. And so we want to redefine that goal to be more appropriate. I think one of the biggest mistakes was for a choice, an implementation choice, around the financing of social insurance, which in the 1880s under Chancellor Bismarck was just a pragmatic solution to a financing problem, how in the 1950s and 60s somehow that got elevated into a principle of social insurance, that you have to have a statutory sole purpose contribution. That is now a principle. It's hard to argue against a principle. And so what we're trying to say is that there's lots of different ways of financing your protection promise, and some are going to be less distortionary than others. Go for the ones that are going to maximize access and maximize resources and the potential for risk sharing. Finally, on this question of flexicurity and skills development, I think we have to go back to basics of public economics. You know, in any skills development effort, there will be some skills that benefit society more than they benefit individuals and firms. Some skills that benefit firms more than they benefit individuals and society. Some skills that benefit just individuals or more individuals more. Depending on who benefits most, then the burden of financing and effort should be on the beneficiary. So where society is the biggest beneficiary, society as a whole, through general revenue, have to put in the biggest effort. But there will be skills that are very industry-specific, that are very firm-specific. And employers should have the incentive, and if they don't, we can nudge them through policy in order to recognize the incentive to continue to invest in the skills development of those particular skill set. But that conversation isn't happening like that. It's happening as, are you investing in skills or aren't you investing in skills, rather than the more refined policy-informed. And we have the tools for this from public economics, and here we are in the library of the School of Public Policy. So what I would say is it's an argument to go back to your basics. You're here to learn toolkit, apply the toolkit. It's doubly more important to remind you of that in this era of tweets that we live in.
Wonderful. I am delighted that we have been awarded the library to the School of Public Policy. I mean, we will be moving on short. I mean, moving not on, moving in shortly. It is a library that we all covet. Well, this has been a fascinating session. At least I feel that I learned a lot, and I'm sure there are other people in the room who probably feel the same way. And for that, we should thank both the authors of the report and the discussants who have joined us here today. So please join me in thanking them with a final round of applause.